each building separated by a low fence and a thin strip of grass. The front doors opposite Agnes's were all thrown open, and women stood watching, a half dozen children milling about each one, all with the same face. It was like the photo of her Granny Campbell and her Irish dozen that Willie had once shown her. Agnes, standing on her stoop, smiled across the low fence and waved, her beaded rabbit sleeves glinting in the light. "Hello," she politely addressed the general congregation.
"You moving in?"
said a woman from the door beyond her own. The woman's blonde hair curled back on dark brown roots. It made her look like she had on a child's wig. "Yes."
"All of yous?"
asked the woman. "Yes, my family and I," corrected Agnes. She introduced herself and held out her hand. The woman scratched at her root line. Agnes wondered whether the woman spoke only in questions when she finally answered.
"I'm Bridie Donnelly. I've lived upstairs for 29 years. I've had 15 downstairs neighbours in all that time."
Agnes felt all the Donnelly eyes on her. A skinny girl with dark round eyes brought a tray of mismatched tea mugs through the door. Everyone took one. They didn't draw their eyes from Agnes as they supped. Bridie nodded over the fence.
"That there is Noreen Donnelly, my cousin, but no my blood, you understand?"
A grey-coloured woman rolled her tongue in her head and nodded sharply. Bridie Donnelly went on.
"That lassie is Jinty McGlinchey, my cousin. She is my blood."
A child-sized woman next door to Noreen took a long drag and a short doubt. Her eyes narrowed from the smoke, and right enough, she looked like Bridie in a headscarf. They all looked like Bridie, even the boys. Only they looked less masculine. From out of the side of her eye, Agnes could feel another woman crossing the dusty street. The woman stopped and talked to the semicircle of raggedy children. She nodded, like they had given her grave news, and marched on through the front gate to the new house. Agnes had no escape. Behind her, Leek came sullenly out of the house for his next load.
"Is that your man?"
said the newly arrived woman without introduction. The meat of her face was as taut as a leathered skull. Her eyes were deep pockets in her head, and her hair was a rich wild brown but thinning, like the coat of an uncombed cat. She stood in bagged out stretch pants, the stirrups stuffed into men's house slippers. Agnes stumbled over the absurdity of the question. There were 20-odd years between her and Leek.
"No, that's my middle wean, 16 in the spring."
"Ah, in the spring, is it?"
The woman considered this for a minute, and then jabbed a sharp finger out at the vegetable van.
"Is that there, your man?"
Agnes looked to remove her, struggling with the old television she had tried to wrap for discretion in a bedsheet.
"No, he's a friend of a friend who's lending a hand."
The woman thought on this. She sucked her gaunt cheeks into her skull head. Agnes made a half wave and a half turn to leave.
"What's that in your sleeves?"
asked the thin woman. Agnes looked down and cradled her fluffy arms protectively, like they were kittens. The rhinestones shook nervously.
"They're just wee beads."
Shona Donnelly, the tea girl, exhaled slowly.
"Ah, missus, I think they're love..."
The thin woman interrupted her.
"Do you even have a man?"
The front door opened again, and Shuggy came out onto the top step. Without addressing the women, he turned to his mother and put his hands on his hips. He thrust a foot forward and said as clear as Agnes had ever heard him speak,
"We need to talk. I really do not think I can live here. It smells like cabbages and batteries. It's simply impossible."
The heads of the audience turned one to another in shock. It was like a dozen faces looking at their own likeness in the mirror.
"Would you get a load of that? Liberace is moving in,"
screamed one of the women. The women and children howled as one, high squeaky laughs and throaty coughs full of catarrh.
I do hope the piano will fit in the parlour.
Well, it's so nice to meet you all, said Agnes, with a thin grimace.
She clutched Shuggy to her hip as she turned to leave.
Oh, dinna be like that. It's nice to meet you and all, hen,
wheezed Bridie, her hard face softening around the eyes from the good howling.
We're all like family here. We just don't get that many new faces.
The skull-faced woman took a step closer to Agnes.
Aye, well, we'll get on just fine.
She sucked as though a piece of meat was stuck between her teeth.
Just as long as you keep your fancy sleeves away from our fucking men.
For the rest of the afternoon, Shuggy walked the edge of the new scheme while the men unpacked the moving van. Women in tight leggings dragged kitchen chairs to their windows and sat watching, empty-faced, as box after box was unloaded. They had taken to greeting the boy with extravagant waves, doffing imaginary caps and then cackling to themselves. In his new outfit, he walked to the far end of the street. There was nothing out there. The street stopped at the edge of the peat box, like it had given up. Dark pools of boggy water sat still and deep and scary-looking. Great forests of brown reeds shot up out of the grass and were slowly inching over the scheme, intent on taking it back from the miners. Shuggy watched shoeless children playing in the stour. From the edge of a clutch of council bushes, he pretended he was cataloguing some small red flowers, studying each for its size, while he waited for the children to ask him to join them. They were riding bikes in circles round each other and ignoring him. He popped the white berries between his fingers, trying to look casually disinterested, and then he tried to wipe the shine off his good shoes with the sticky juice. The miners' tackety boots made sparks on the tarmac. The men slowly started drifting one by one along the empty road. There was no colliery whistle now. Still, the men were pushed along by the muscle memory of a dead routine, heading home at finishing time with nothing being finished, only a belly full of ale and a back cowed with worry. Their donkey jackets were clean, and their boots were still shiny as they jerked along the road. Shuggy stepped back as they passed, their heads lowered like those of tired black mules. Without a word, each man collected a handful of thin children who followed obediently like reverential shadows. Agnes stood behind the front door and closed the large glass draft door ahead of her. She couldn't think. In the small pocket between the two doors, she finished the can that she'd secreted in the bottom of her bag. She pressed her face against the wall, cold and soothing. The stone was thick and damp, and she could tell it would be slow to heat up. She stood in the hiding place for a long while before she walked the length of the hallway past two small bedrooms. Catherine was standing in the middle of the first, moving neither here nor there. The wild miners' wains were resting their elbows on the outside ledge and looking in the bedroom window at her like it was a zoo. Dumbfounded, she could only stare back. The wood-framed windows were poorly fitted, and the chipped glazing putty warned of cold nights and wet walls. Agnes could hear the wains talking as clearly as if they were in the room with her. Leek had found the other room. He had opened the bag that kept his drawing supplies and was lying on the bare floor drawing a charcoal picture of the Black Hills. He took the edge of the pastel and drew the figures of the dark-jacketed men who had watched them as they arrived. They lined the mound of the hills like trees with no leaves. She watched her son, jealous of his talent to disappear, to float away and leave them all behind. There were no more bedrooms after that. The third that they had been promised was clearly the living room. And as she retraced her steps, two and then three times, she knew all the children would need to be put together in one single room again. Shug was standing at the end of the hallway looking blankly at her. His comb-over had been dancing in the wind, and he caught the waving strands and, with a lick of spittle, tried to smooth it back down over his head. He stepped back inside the open kitchenette and motioned for her to follow. The kitchen had a large clothes pulley hanging from the ceiling that looked like a torture rack. At the far end hung a set of miner's working clothes, neatly arranged to dry, from socks to white underwear to a blue polyester work shirt, all stiff with age. Would the man who they belonged to ever be back from the mines? Maybe they had the wrong house after all. The facing of the chipboard cabinets was peeling in places, and Shug stood working his pinky finger under one of the laminates. Behind him, in the corner above the cooker, sprawled a vine of black mould. Without looking at her, he simply said, "I can't stay." At first, she barely looked up. She had thought he meant only to go out on a shift and make money. He did that often. Came home from a shift only to stand up again and announce he was heading back out. He had never been a man given to sitting at home. "What time would you like your dinner?" she asked, already worrying about chip pans and bread knives.
"I don't want your dinners anymore. Don't you get it?"
He was shaking his head.
"This is it. I can't stay anymore. I can't stay with you. All you're wanting. All that drinking."
It was then she saw that the brocade cases were settled amongst the packing boxes, but the red cases were not. She must have had a look of profound confusion on her face, because Shug met her eyes and was nodding slowly, like you did when a child swallowed medicine, goading it on, waiting for the ick of it to reach the gut. Agnes looked away. She didn't want to understand. She didn't want his medicine. She stopped looking for the chip pan, started rearranging the beads on her jumper so that the shiny, faceted sides were uniform and facing outward, stalling for time, unsure of what to do now.
"This is it," he said again.
There was a single chair in the room, a broken-backed kitchen chair, covered in paint splashes and used for reaching high cabinets. Agnes closed the kitchen door quietly. Out in the hallway, the children were already complaining, aware now that there were not enough bedrooms. She put the broken chair in front of the closed door and sat down.
"Why am I not enough for you?"
Shug blinked, like he could not believe what he was hearing. He shook his head, and as he spoke, he prodded himself in the chest.
"No, my lady. Why was I not enough?"
"I've never so much as looked at another man."
"That's not what I meant."
He rubbed at his eyes like he was tired.
"Why did you no love me enough to stay off the drink, eh? I buy you the best of gear. I work all the hours God sent."
He stared at the wall, not at it, but through it.
"I even thought, maybe if I gave you a wane of my own. But no, even that wasn't enough to keep you still."
Taking her roughly by the elbow, he tried to lift her from the seat. Agnes shook herself free and sat back down like she was in a peaceful protest. She was in the dangerous in-between place. Enough drink to feel combative, but not enough to be unreasonable yet. A few mouthfuls more, and she would become destructive, mean-mouthed, spiteful. He stared at her as if he were reading the weather coming down from the glen. He took hold of her and tried to shift her again before the great rain clouds inside her burst. She wrenched herself from his grasp, sat down again, and drew herself to her full height. She regarded him coldly for a long while. She could still not believe what was happening.
"No,
not good enough. This doesn't happen to women like me. I mean, look at me. Look at you.
You're embarrassing yourself.
He pulled on the front of her jumper. Shug moved her by force then. She did not cry out as he took her by the hair and pulled her to the floor. Agnes pressed herself against the bottom of the kitchen door as though she could keep him inside forever. He slammed the door into the back of her head, like she was only a loose corner of carpet. As he stepped over her, his right brogue caught the underside of her chin, splitting the pearl-white skin clean open.
"Please, I love you, I do,"
she said. "Aye, I know that."
By the time the hackney had turned on the pit road, her children were in the hallway, and Agnes, sparkling and fluffy, was lying like a party dress that had been dropped on the floor. The red leather cases never made it into the miner's house. Shug did not come back to see her for several days, and when he did, he didn't have the cases with him. He had taken them to Joni Micklewhite's and slid them into the space she had cleared for him under her bed. Agnes did not know that at first. Shug simply reappeared one night, gently kissed the gash on her chin, and laid her down on the fold-out settee in the living room. Shug started coming in during his night shifts and using her in this way. He waited until the small hours, when the children would be in bed. Then he whistled nonchalantly up the hallway in freshly pressed shirts. As she undressed him, she could tell his underwear was clean and boil-washed by another woman. When they were done, he would lie there for a moment until Agnes wrapped her arms around him, and then he would stand up and leave. If she cooked for him, he would maybe stay a little longer. If she started in on him with question or complaint, he would leave, and he would stay away for several nights in punishment. After he'd gone, Agnes would lie on the fold-out settee because she could not take to their bed without him. She lay awake the rest of the night staring at the ceiling while the boys slept in their bedroom next door. All that first autumn, Catherine would climb onto the mattress with her mother, and they would lie there together under the damp and the growing mould.
"Why don't we just go back to Sight Hill?"
Catherine would whisper. But Agnes couldn't explain through the hurt. She knew he would never come back if she returned to her mother's. She was to stay where she was dropped. She was to take any little kindness he would give. Eventually, Guy Fawkes night arrived, and the air was thick with bonfire wood and burning tires. Leek and Catherine stood at the window and watched homemade pyres burn across the boggy blackness. Wains launched fireworks at each other like they were whistling missiles. It seemed like rare fun. The television was still half unwrapped from its bedsheet and placed on the floor in the corner, not yet a full commitment. Catherine sank into the settee, her wet hair wrapped in a turban towel. It'd be the late news, and then another night of listening to her mother weep in the dark. Agnes waited in the back, in the kitchen. With the lights turned off, it was the room with the best view of the pit road. Every night, she watched for the hackney and got her hopes up with the approaching hum of any diesel engine. She'd been drinking all the day away, but it wasn't helping any. She walked between the window and her stash below the kitchen sink. From the click of the latch, the children could count the time she opened the cabinet and snuck a drink.
"Mammy, what's for eating?"
Leek shouted from the settee. Agnes stopped picking at the scab on her chin. She looked at the pot on the electric cooker.
"I could heat you some of this soup." "The one with the peas in it?"
Leek asked.
"Yes." "Well, not if it's got peas in it," said Leek, a little hurt that his 15-year war against green vegetables went unnoticed. "Hello? It's pea soup, you big dafty,
mocked Catherine. Leek dug his foot into her side and pulled the towel off her head, ripping some of her hair along with it. He threw it in the far corner for spite.
Get it up, ye,
he mouthed silently. They had agreed, without ever discussing it outright, to tread as lightly as they could around their mother. Catherine stood up to fetch the towel from the other side of the room. She had held on to her virginity as Lizzie had warned her to, so now it wouldn't be long till she was married to Donald Jr., and then she wouldn't have to share a bedroom with either her brother or her mother in this cold damp. The thought alone stopped her from leaving. She was on her way out anyway. Catherine rewrapped her hair and flicked her brother the finger. She went through to check on her mother. Agnes was distractedly circling the kitchen like a toy train. Every so often she stopped and opened the cabinet under the sink, filled a mug from a container within a plastic bag, and took a long drink. Catherine nudged the cabinet door open with her toe. With relief, she saw it was not bleach Agnes had been pouring into the mug. Catherine wrinkled her nose at the congealed soup pot.
Mammy, how about phoning in a wee Chinese?
Good idea, Leek chimed in from the other room. Catherine had said only Chinese, but Agnes had heard shug. She had the strange power to tie anything back to him these days. Her eyes came into sharp focus.
I could phone the rank and see if Shug's coming round the night, she offered brightly. Maybe he'll bring a Chinese over.
Catherine groaned. Agnes had been warned not to phone the rank anymore. Shug had added it to the long list of things she had to stop if she ever wanted him home. It was his emotional ransom. Perhaps, though, if he knew the children were hungry, he'd come over and things would be okay for a few hours. She could fix herself up nice, and maybe he would spend the whole night with her on the fold-out settee. Agnes took a mouthful from her mug and thought through her script. Sound normal, sober, non-committal. Keep it easy and smile down the phone. It hadn't worked any night before. She didn't know why, but she wanted badly to try again. Agnes sat at the little pleather phone table and lit a cigarette for her nerves. When she finished dialing, she turned her engagement ring back around, as though the person on the other end could see. The gold of her wedding band had turned a dirty-looking yellow. A woman's voice in the phone answered with an annoyed crackle.
Northside Taxis!
It was Joni Micklewhite. Agnes knew her only casually.
Hello, Joni. Is that you? It's Mrs. Bain.
Oh, hello, Hen. What can I do you for?
Joni sounded flat, like when you turn the corner and run into someone you'd rather never see again.
Can you get a message out to Shug to please phone home? Agnes said.
She wondered then whether Joni knew he had left her. She wondered who at the rank knew he wasn't sleeping in her bed.
Let me try. Can you hold on, Hen?
The phone went quiet as Joni put the line on hold and tried to contact Shug's taxi over the big CB radio. It took an eternity before Joni came back on the line.
You still there?
She caught Agnes mid-puff. Agnes exhaled the smoke above her head.
Still holding. Did you get through to him?
Joni paused slightly, and Agnes stiffened for rejection.
Aye. He said he'd give you a phone in a while.
Agnes brightened up. Something like hope caught in her chest, and she looked forward to seeing him, her own husband. She thought about the velvet dress she would wear for him. She wondered if she had time to shave her legs. Then Joni added,
Agnes, I know he hasn't told you everything, Hen, she stuttered on. I just wanted you to know that when you do find out, I'd never meant for anything like this to happen. I have seven wains of my own and, well, I'm sorry.
The last of the bonfires were dying by the time Shug arrived. The children were in bed, sullen and hungry. Agnes couldn't touch any of the Chinese. She watched his hair fall from his bald head as he shoveled great mouthfuls into his gullet. Through all this, he hadn't lost his appetite, and that killed her. Agnes rubbed at her temples and sat amongst all the unpacked unpacking. There were still no red cases.
Does she keep a nice house?
No, really, he said, without looking up.
Agnes drank as much lager as she could in one go, before she needed to lower the can to take another breath. When she was done, she asked,
So, is she good looking?
I told you on the phone. Don't want to fucking talk about her.
He ripped a slice of white bread in two.
Let me eat my dinner in peace. I didn't drive it here to fight.
Agnes was quiet for a long time, thinking carefully about what to say next. Her left hand worried her knife. She was caught between wanting to start a fight and stab him, and wanting him to stay a little longer. When she spoke again, she tried to keep her voice even and calm. She found it helped not to look at him.
It's not going to happen, is it? Our new start.
Shug stopped chewing. He shrugged.
This is a new start, Agnes. I couldn't cope anymore.
She cupped her hands over her face. The polish on her nails was bright, as if still wet.
Why the fuck did you bring me here?
Shug pushed his plate away. His moustache was heavy with a congealing pink sauce.
Had to see.
Had to see
what? She asked, her voice cracking in anger.
I thought this is what you wanted.
I had to see if you would actually come.
Agnes took hold of the neck of his jumper then. Shug picked up his money belt and kissed her with a forceful tongue. He had to squeeze all the small bones in her hands to get her to release him. She had loved him, and he had needed to break her completely to leave her for good. Agnes Bain was too rare a thing to let someone else love. It wouldn't do to leave pieces of her for another man to collect and repair later. Chapter 9. Agnes had to sink 3 whole lager cans before she could go out the front door. A group of women stood in a cluster by the fence, their arms folded like car bumpers. It was like they had been waiting there since she had moved in 4 months prior. The cold didn't seem to bother them. The ground was littered with cigarette doubts, and there were dirty tea mugs stacked in the fence posts. They stopped talking and turned as one when she came out the front door. Holding her head high, Agnes made sure the clicks of her black heels were sharp and clear on the pavement. She smiled haughtily at the women in their leggings and slippers. She passed them by, heading up the road to the miners' club, to forgetfulness. The women looked on silently. She was almost out of earshot before one of them spoke.
We've no had a falling out already, have we?
Said Bridie. Her streaked hair was still unbrushed, her thick trunk wrapped in men's jogging pants and a housecoat. Agnes didn't turn around.
What gave you that idea?
You've no invited us to your party. Are we no pals?
What party?
Agnes half turned.
Well, where else are you going dressed on nice like that?
The Miners Club. I wanted to see what you lot did for fun.
The women all looked one to another. They twisted at their St. Christopher's medallions nervously.
Don't be bothering about that, Bridie said. The men don't like it when we show our faces up there. Stay here with us, and we'll hear a wee welcome drink to ourselves.
Bridie drew a large, clear bottle from behind one of the fence posts. She tossed the contents of her tea mug into the street and shook the vodka bottle.
Why don't you come over here and tell us all about yourself?
Agnes stepped closer and watched the bitter liquid eat the ring of tea scum. She held her hand up in moderation as the pure vodka neared the top and gave a prim giggle. Bridie glanced at her sideways and filled the mug to the very top.
Here's peace. I can't have you thinking we're cheap.
Agnes took the mug with a polite thanks. The women ran their eyes up and down their new neighbour. The strappy heels, the hard-set hair, the beautiful fur coat. Agnes glanced up and down the empty road and let them drink it all in. The knights were gathering in again. The streetlights were on, and a gang of collarless dogs wandered from stank to stank, sniffing the rotten drains. One pissed, and the others took their turns and marked the same spot. She turned back to the women, and they were smiling hungrily at her.
Well, cheers then.
She chinked the tea mug against theirs. Someone took a pouch of rolling tobacco out and passed it around. Jinty licked some fag papers and tenderly poured a thin line of golden tobacco in.
Put that away, said Agnes,
seeing a chance to repay them for the vodka. She reached into the deep pockets and pulled a pack of Kensitas out of the mink coat. Bridie looked at the glossy gold packet at the gold-plated lighter.
Jeezo, it's like the Queen of England has moved in. It makes a right difference when you don't have to pick the baccy off your teeth.
Jinty agreed. The women took one each and lit the cigarettes. They all took long, greedy draws and savoured the taste in silence. They held the cigarettes between the thumb and forefinger, as if gripping a pea shooter. They studied Agnes, her painted nails dancing in front of her face like so many red ladybugs. Between delicate fingers, she took light, shallow puffs as they sucked their cheeks thin. Then she lifted her other hand and took deep, greedy mouthfuls from the mug.
Where are you free then?
Asked Jinty, reaching out to touch her emerald earrings.
Originally, Jarmiston, but I suppose you could say all over the East End. I've moved a fair bit.
All over the East End, eh?
Echoed Bridie, nodding sagely.
A good Catholic woman, then? What brings you out here to our wee scheme?
Agnes faltered.
My man heard it was a nice place to live, safe from my wains.
She paused.
Good neighbours.
Aye, said Bridie with a laugh. It's no Butlins, but that sounds like the good old days. That mine has been dying for years. There's hardly nae work there for naebody anymore. Every year we've got mair men sat at home, wanking in the daylight.
There's a couple who've still got jobs. Mainly filling in the holes to make sure no kiddies fall in,
added Noreen.
Don't want any mere accidents, see?
Accidents?
Asked Agnes.
Aye, it's always been a gassy seam. They used to have to pump the methane out just to work it. Mind, the men knew this. They knew what they were working against and respected it best they could. But one day it just fell in on the poor souls. Pure collapsed. There was an explosion that burnt them all up. Left some wains we know daddies.
Jinty was still staring at Agnes's earrings.
It made a lot of lonely women.
They turned and looked at the house that belonged to the woman with the skull face. Bridie sighed.
Don't worry about Colleen McIvenny. Her bark's worse than her bite.
Is she your cousin as well?
Oh aye, but no blood, you see. She's just protective of her Jamesy. Used to be he was a good-looking fella. He was a big burly banksman.
Used to ferry them up and down in a cage lift in that shaft. Got burnt in that mine. Took the skin all off his shoulder and the side of his neck. Red as a July sunburn.
The women bowed their heads, almost as a sign of respect.
A fine-looking man, nonetheless.
Anyways, where did your man go off to with them fancy red cases?
Asked Jinty, suddenly.
He's a taxi driver. Sometimes he needs to take his stuff with him.
She lied. It was thin.
He works the night shift.
Jinty sucked at her teeth. She laid a sympathetic hand on Agnes's.
We weren't born yesterday, hen. He looked to me like he was leaving for longer than that.
Bridie waved her cigarette at Jinty.
Ach, never mind her. Don't sink to her level. All we are saying is, we've all got men, and we've all got men trouble.
The women puffed on their fags in empathy. Noreen looked worried.
How you gonna feed yourself if he doesn't come back?
Money was always on her mind. Her heart was gnawed with the worry.
I don't know.
The women looked from one to another. Bridie spoke first.
We'll have to get you on benefits. You can go up the office on Monday morning. You'll have to tell them you're needing disability allowance, otherwise I'll have you up at the dole every Thursday.
Will they sign me on to disability?
I wouldn't worry, hen. They'll take one look at your address and give it to you easy. Look at this place.
Bridie waved her hand into the empty street.
It's no like there are any new jobs coming here. Disability is the only club we've got, and Monday is club day.
Agnes lifted the vodka mug again and stared down into the faint clouds. The tea must have been very milky. Bridie topped her up to the brim with a smile.
Aye, I took you for a drinker.
She drew in her fag.
Aye, the minute I saw you, I spotted it. They thought you were the big I am, all done up in sequins like some big dolly bird from the city. But I could see through it. I could see the sadness. And I knew you had to be a big drinker.
The woman nodded and cawed.
Aye.
Like a murder of crows. Agnes froze with the mug on her lips.
Do you drink anything and everything?
Asked Bridie.
Pardon?
Said Agnes, lowering the mug.
Is it a very bad problem you've got?
Clarified Bridie.
I don't have a problem.
Look, hen, you're standing out here drinking vodka in the middle of the street. You'll have no problem signing on the disability looking like that.
You have a mug of vodka as well?
Agnes was affronted. Their mouths turned downwards unkindly as they tilted their mugs towards her in the orange streetlight. The filmy whiteness of milky tea showed in each one.
No, hen, we're drinking piss-cold tea, scolded Bridie. It's only ye who's necking vodka like it was tap water.
Agnes's face smarted red. The woman smiled pityingly through tight lips. The pupils of their eyes, hooded by their lids, looked black in the orange streetlight. Agnes looked into the mug and threw the rest of the vodka down the back of her throat.
Bridie held up her hand. Listen, one day at a time and all that shite. I've had a wee problem myself. 6 wains and a husband out of work. You better believe I'd drink.
She squashed the finished cigarette doubt into the dust with a sandaled toe.
It was the blackouts that did me in, though. I couldn't take that first 5 minutes of every day waking up and wondering who said what to who and what bastard I had a fight with. You'd go into the kitchen scratching for a cup of tea, and they all look at you sideways. Then you'd look around and one of them would have a black eye. Then you'd go to the mirror, and you'd have one and all.
The women all nodded in empathy. Nobody laughed. Jinty added,
I've stood up at Dolan's shop talking about Dallas with women I dragged along the street by the hair the night afore.
She curled her hands into fists, her thin body animated by the scandal. Then she pointed at Skullface's house across the road.
Do you all remember the time Colleen felt Isa was making eyes at Big Jamesy?
Bridie tutted.
That was a nonsense. They're blood. Everybody always forgets that. Well, there was no telling Colleen about that.
Jinty turned to Agnes.
Now, our Colleen doesn't take a drink. She's right close to the baby Jesus, takes him everywhere in her heart. But this one Monday morning, she took a drink, a right good hammering. She's gone up the post office and done in her Monday book, spent every fucking penny and swilled it down their neck. Her wains were greeting and starving and she drank every drop. She gets a plastic bag and goes up and down that road, scooping up dog shite. White ones, black ones, runny and hard, near fills the bag to the top. She took this bag of dog shite and staggers up the road there.
Jinty pointed towards the slag hills.
She puts on a yellow marigold glove and she starts throwing. I mean, absolutely covers the front of Isa's house. She was throwing that shite and screaming for Big Jamesy to come out there and face her like a man.
What happened? Agnes asked.
Aye, I'm getting to it.
Jinty slung a sly look over her shoulder to Colleen's gate.
She showers the place in dog shite. You could smell it for miles. It goes on the windows, sticks to the pebble dash. Drenched. Lord knows, I'm no a big fan of Isa. Her man took early redundancy from the pit and she spent it at the bingo and won a pretty penny. But I do not condone throwing shite in the street like a savage.
Bridie took up the tale.
Anyway, turns out Big Jamesy wasn't diddling Isa. He was working. Working? Of all the things to be doing, he got himself a part-time job hauling scrap and couldn't tell anyone for fear they'd shop him to the disability.
Jinty kissed her St. Christopher.
Here, Colleen thought he was at it, and the man was out trying to make a bit of extra money. Thank God for blackouts.
Bridie crossed herself solemnly.
Look, I know why you're drinking. It's hard to cope sometimes. I steer clear of the drink, but I still need a couple of these every day.
She took a baby's aspirin bottle out of her pocket.
Bridie's little pals.
Aspirin?
Asked Agnes.
No.
Bridie licked her top lip. She leaned in closer.
Valium. If you want, just try a couple. A wee taste, that's all. If you want more, I'll look after you. Special price.
Bridie pushed down and unscrewed the lid of the small plastic bottle with a smile. She tipped two into Agnes's palm like they were sweeties.
Here, just try it. And welcome to Pithead.
Chapter 10. His mother was nowhere to be found. He cupped the bone-white tooth in his hand. The little incisor floated in a pool of spittle and blood, and he was sure he might die. Was this what happened, now that he was 7? He was afraid to probe his teeth with his tongue should they all come loose. He needed to find her to ask, but his mother was gone. Shuggy stood with his face against the rusty metal gate and watched a pack of pit dogs roam by. 5 male dogs harassed a small black female dog. They made a high yipping noise as they prowled past, and Shuggy pushed his lips between the fence slats and sang along with them. Yip, yip, yip. He listened to the dog's song, and it was as if they were calling him outside. He wasn't allowed out the front gate without telling her. But then, she wasn't here. Keeping his plimsolls planted firmly inside, he stuck his head out and looked left and then looked right. He played a game of holding his breath and then darting out and darting back, all the while stealing glances up and down the short road to try to see her. She wasn't there. The pack of dogs called him out of the gate. Shuggy picked up his dirty blonde dolly and tossed her out onto the pavement. Daphne landed with a raspy crack and made a snow angel in the dust. He leapt out and grabbed her, darting back inside like a little bony fish, closing the gate with a loud metal clang. He looked over his shoulder. No one came to the window, and no one came to Bridie Donnelly's window. There was no one watching. She wasn't there. Shuggy opened the gate again and followed the dogs. There was a clutch of women standing in men's slippers on the corner. They had been talking animatedly about something, but he saw how they lowered their voices as he approached. One of them turned and curtsied towards him. Trying to look casual, like he didn't care, he made a show of dancing along the dusty road past the chapel on the hill. He made a great game of kicking plumes of dust into the sky and danced farther and farther from home. He came to the Catholic school and watched children play at their morning break. He stood in the shade of a horse chestnut tree and wondered why he wasn't in school himself. There hadn't been cartoons on that morning, so it hadn't been Saturday. He knew that much. But she hadn't laid his clothes out like she sometimes did, so he hadn't gone, and she hadn't said anything. The boys were mercilessly kicking a bladder into the corner of the playground, and they saw him before he noticed them watching.
"What's that you've got?"
shouted the smaller of the Brown brothers, the sons of the skull-faced woman, Colleen McAvaney. Shuggy instinctively hid the Daphne doll behind his back.
"Hello,"
said Shuggy, with a polite wave. He mimicked the swishing curtsy of the miner's wife and gracefully extended his left leg out behind himself. Open-mouthed, they peered through the peeling railings and drew their eyes up and down the length of him.
"How come you're not in school?"
asked Gerbil, the younger one, picking flakes of green paint from the iron.
"I don't know,"
Shuggy admitted with a shrug. The boys were only a few years older than him, but were already thick-built and brown from summers spent outside, exploring marshes and throwing cats into the pit's quarries. He had seen them easily move heavy loads of their father's scrap from the back of his lorry. Francis McAvaney narrowed his dark eyes and said,
"It's all 'cause your mammy is an old alky."
He watched Shuggy's face to see the sting of the words. Gerbil McAvaney put a flake of iron paint between his lips.
"How come you don't have a daddy?"
His voice was already deep like a man's.
I do,
Shuggy stuttered. Gerbil smiled.
"Where is he then?"
This Shuggy didn't know. He had heard he was a whoremaster and that he was raising another woman's wains while he fucked every bastarding thing that sat in the back of his taxi. But it didn't seem right to admit this.
"He's on night shift, making money for our holidays."
The break bell went, and Father Barry came out to line up the playing children. Gerbil reached his hand through the fence, his long fingers snatching at Shuggy's doll. Francis gurgled like a happy baby and joined in the game till they were both grabbing wildly. Shuggy stepped back into the shade of the horse chestnut tree.
"I'm telling Father Barry and you should be in school,"
they screamed. Clutching Daphne to his chest, Shuggy turned on his heels and ran away as quickly as he could. He was out of breath by the time he came across the miners' club, but he could still hear the McAvaney boys calling out for Father Barry. The club was run down and empty-looking. Shuggy pulled himself up and hung from the bars on the windows. Then he idled around the forecourt, where spent lager kegs bled out puddles of flat ale. The dirty lager mixed with petrol and made lochans of shining rainbows. Shuggy knelt down and pushed Daphne's blonde hair into the iridescent puddle. When he took her out, the shiny yellow hair had turned the colour of night, and he tutted. Where were the beautiful rainbow colours? He pushed her down again and held her under the surface longer this time. Her eyes automatically closed,
like she was sleeping. But she was smiling, so he knew she was okay. When he lifted the doll out of the puddle, the black liquid rolled off her face and down onto her white woolen dress. Her cheap yellow hair had turned matte black. He stared at it and realised that, for a minute, he had forgotten about his mother. Daphne smelled funny. For a while, he weaved in and out of the lager puddles. He peered out onto the road, and when he was absolutely sure Father Barry was not looking for him, he darted across the road and into the mouth of a wooded lane he had not seen before. The lane backed a row of older-looking miners' cottages that were joined at the back with a communal garden. At the near edge of the garden sat a large brick bin shed. It was flat and rectangular, with no windows and a dark opening, where a painted green door now hung open and broken. At the side of the bin shed lay a washing machine, the kind used in hospitals or government buildings, solid and big as a wardrobe. It was too heavy for the binmen to take away, so it lay rusting next to the shed, and fat, lazy flies dipped in and out of its shadow. Inside the machine sat a boy, with his legs above his head, curled around the drum like a broken-backed cat.
"Want a spin in my carnival ride?"
Shuggy was startled to find him in there. The boy swung inside the drum and rocked in semicircles. In 1 second, his feet were above his head. The next, his head were above his feet.
"Look, it's dead fun," he coaxed.
Shuggy held Daphne out to him and offered her up for first go. The boy uncurled from inside the drum, pushing out his long brown legs like a spider through a keyhole. He arched his body out backwards, straightening. He was almost as tall as the metal machine. He was a good year older than Shuggy, at least 8 or 9, starting the long stretch already.
"Hiya, my name's Johnny. My ma calls us Bonnie Johnny," he said with a tight smile. "It's supposed to be like a wrestler's name, but I think it's pure shite."
He slapped his own forearm like the wrestlers on television did before a fight. He chopped at the empty air.
"What's your name, wee man?"
"Hugh Bain," he said in a shy voice. "Shuggy."
The boy was watching him, peering through half-lidded eyes the same way Shuggy had seen the miners' children squint when he raised his hand in class. It was a blend of disbelief and disdain. He'd often seen his granny look at his father this way. Shuggy turned his left kneecap inwards. Then Johnny smiled. His face changed so quickly it made Shuggy take a step back. It was like a flick of a light switch, and his face brightened like a bare bulb in an empty room.
"Is that a dolly you've got, Shuggy?"
The boy was using his name like he had known him a long while. Without waiting for an answer, he added,
"Are you a wee girl?"
He stepped into the long grass, flattening it as he came. Shuggy shook his head again.
"If you're no a wee girl, then you must be a wee puth."
He tightened his smile. His voice was low and sweet, like he was talking to a puppy.
"You're no a wee puth, are you?"
Shuggy didn't know what a puff was, but he knew it was bad. Catherine called Leakit when she wanted to hurt his feelings.
"Do you know what a puff there is, wee man? A puff is a boy who does dirty things with other boys."
Johnny was up against Shuggy now, nearly double his height.
"A puff is a boy who wants to be a wee girl."
Bonnie Johnny was a dirty white colour, like he had been steeped in tea. He had sepia skin and honey-coloured hair and eyes like amber lager. When Johnny smiled, he had all his big boy teeth already. Shuggy worried the gap in his own smile with his tongue. Johnny snatched the doll from him and tossed her into the drum.
"See? She wants a ride."
Johnny pressed himself into Shuggy's back
put his arms around his waist, and lifted him up into the mouth of the machine. Shuggy climbed up into the drum, and he felt a helping hand give him a final push as he tumbled in. Clutching Daphne, he looked back out into the daylight, his bare legs chilled by the cold metal. Johnny grabbed a raised ridge inside the drum and moved it slowly from left to right, rocking it as gently as a baby's crib. Shuggy fell over and scrambled for ballast against the swinging. He tensed all his muscles and bared his teeth like a scared cat. Daphne slid away, clanging around the cylinder. Johnny kept on rocking gently.
See? It's not that bad, is it?
The motion came to remind Shuggy of the pirate ship ride that sat outside his grandfather's favourite bakery. He gurgled with involuntary laughter.
Hold on, said Johnny.
He gripped the metal ridge tighter, and bracing his body against the machine for purchase, he rocked it harder. Shuggy's head and knees travelled in semicircles as Daphne hit the roof. The muscles on Johnny's neck stood out as he pulled the drum round with all his might. Shuggy spun head over heels. He spun over and over again and again, his head cracking on the metal paddles, his foot hitting him square in the back. The drum slowed, and Shuggy crashed into an upside-down heap. A thick arm grabbed one of the metal bars and stopped the centrifuge. A siren wail rose in Shuggy as the pain shot down through his crown, his split knee and his bruised shins. From behind his waterfall of tears, he could see a large hand come down again and again on Johnny's head, the boy ducking for cover to protect his face. The attacker was too tall for Shuggy to see a face, just the angry lashings of a tattooed arm, slapping the boy's bare neck and shoulders.
What in the name of the wee man have I tell you about playing with that fucking washing machine?
Scolded the headless torso. With his fat thumb, the man jabbed towards the drum.
Get the fuck out of there, afore I really give you something to greet about.
As swiftly as the figure had arrived, it disappeared again. Johnny stood in the opening looking like a battered dog. His smile was gone, his ears were pinned down. He reached in and plucked Shuggy out of the drum.
Listen, you stop that greeting, or I'll give you something to greet about.
Out of the drum, the daylight was almost blinding. The pain in his head stole the colour from his sight. Johnny looked the boy up and down. There was blood on Shuggy's leg from where the metal had burst the skin, and bruises were already showing on his arms and legs. Johnny whipped him around the corner through the black flies and into the cool darkness of the bin shed. It smelt sour as curdled yoghurt. In the dark, Johnny spat in his hand and rubbed it over the boy's wet face and then down the length of his bloody leg. It made everything worse. The blood became a spittle wash, smearing further instead of wiping away. The boy grew panicked, his eyes wide in fear. He ripped a handful of large green docking leaves out of the dirt and scraped them up and down Shuggy's leg. He scrubbed until the blood lifted off and was replaced by a thick trail of mushed green plant mucus. The chlorophyll stung the cut. Shuggy started to gurn again.
Hodge still, you piffy wee bastard!
All the tones of his earlier friendliness were gone. Shuggy could see his father's red hand marks blooming across Johnny's sepia skin. It was quiet in the bin shed, but for the buzz of fat blue bottles. Johnny rubbed and rubbed the little boy's leg until his breathing calmed. His rubbing turned Shuggy from white to red to a deep green. As the panic left Johnny's eyes, slowly the fake smile returned to his tanned face. It was very dark in the bin shed. Bonnie Johnny stood up again, a wiry silhouette against the bright daylight. He handed Shuggy the pulped green leaves, and then he took down his gym shorts.
Stop gurning, he said through his big boy teeth.
Now you rub me.
By the time Shuggy had limped back to the miners' club, the sun had nearly dried up the rainbow puddles. He'd left Daphne in the machine. He didn't ever want to go back. As he climbed the stairs to the hallway, he could hear her on the phone.
Fuck you, Joni Micklewhite. You tell that whore-mastering son of a proddy bitch that he cannot have his cake and eat it too.
Each filthy syllable was enunciated with the alarming clarity of the Queen's English.
You shitty, dick-sucking bastard! You are as plain and tasteless as the arse end of a white loaf!
The receiver went down with a clang, and the bells tinkled with the impact. Shuggy reached the end of the hallway and turned the corner. His mother sat cross-legged at the little telephone table with a mug on her knee. She looked at him like he had risen from the carpet itself. She didn't notice his missing tooth or the leg, stained with blood and spit and docking. Plastered on her face was the glassy grimace that came from under the kitchen sink. She took her earring and threw it across the room before she picked up the phone again.
Now I'm in a mood to tell your granny where to fucking go.
The house was only a stone's throw from the bus stop, but Leek walked home very slowly. His legs were heavy from the day's graft on the youth training scheme, his insides heavy with the dread of what might lie at home. He only hoped for a peaceful hour so he could draw, but it had been a year free of peace since they had moved to the pit. He knew Catherine would not come home again tonight. She was getting adept at sneaking around under Agnes's nose, holding her secret life with Donald Jr. away from their disintegrating mother. Instead, Catherine blamed her boss for all manner of slave driving and told Agnes she would be late at the office and would need to stay at her granny's. Leek saw how his mother worried over money, how she worshipped Catherine's weekly pittance, and so she said nothing. Leek knew Catherine really was at Donald Jr.'s, lying in the blow-up mattress in his mother's spare room and trying to keep her hand locked over her modesty until Donald finally married her. After all his years of practice, Leek was angry that it was Catherine who was disappearing first. It was still daylight, but there were harsh lights on in every room, and the curtains lay open in a shameful way. It was a very bad sign. In the front room, Shuggy was idling between the net curtain and the glass. His palms and nose were pressed flat against the window. He was rocking his head back and forth in a soothing way, and no one was telling him to stop. When he saw his brother, he mouthed, "Leek," and left a grease smear on the glass. The net curtains fluttered to life. A shadow fell across the window, and Agnes appeared behind her youngest. Leek raised his hand in a half wave and put his other on the gate in a gesture that said he was coming home. Agnes smiled out at him, the two toothy grimace that telegraphed a thousand messages. Her eyes seemed dull to him, unfixed, and instantly he knew she was gone. She disappeared again, back to the telephone table, back to the drink. Leek picked up his tool bag and turned away from the house. There was an insistent chink-chink on the glass. Shuggy's lips were wide as he over-enunciated dramatically.
"Where are you going?"
Leek mouthed silently.
"To Granny's."
Shuggy tried to steady his lips.
"Can I come?" "No, it's too far. I can't carry you."
What he never told Shuggy was that he had once found his real father's address, Brendan McGowan. It was there in Agnes's phone book, circled in many different colours and thicknesses of ink, as if she had gone back to it again and again over the years. Leek had walked to this address the winter before and had sat on the wall opposite the broad Victorian tenement. He'd watched a man come home from work, a man he didn't recognise, but who shared the same tired stoop. A man with eyes of the same light grey. The man parked his car in front of the building and then walked past Leek on the street with nothing more than a polite nod. As the door opened, three small faces had raced down the close to greet him. Leek had watched the happy, rowdy family sit and eat at a dining table pressed against the front window. He'd watched them talk over the top of each other, the children standing defiantly upright on the dining chairs as the man laughed at their excitement. Leek had watched for a long time before he folded the address and dropped it between the slats of a storm drain. Leek picked up his tool bag and headed out of Pithead. He turned his back to Shuggy and dared not look again at the pleading face in the window. It was going to rain, and it would be a long walk to Sight Hill. He was tired. He had been tired for a long time now. All he wanted was a rest. Chapter 11. Colourless daylight poured through the net curtains. It poked her in the face, and with a snort, she thumped back into consciousness. Agnes opened her eyes slowly and found herself staring at the cream Artex ceiling with its icy stalagmite texture. Her lips wouldn't close over the sticky film on her top teeth as the dry bulk rose inside her. Under her right hand, she felt the slippery damask fabric of the armchair. Her fingers traced the familiar fag-burn holes. She was vaguely upright, cradling a dead phone receiver. She sat still a while, her head tilted over the back of the chair like an open pedal bin. She closed her eyes again and listened to her brain thump loudly. Like a tide, the blood flushed in and out of her skull. Over the ebb, she could tell the house was empty. It was early, but the boy had taken himself off to school again. He had already missed too many days. Too many days sat at her feet, just waiting and watching. The school didn't like that. Father Barry had said that the social work would have to be notified if he did not start having a regular attendance. Some mornings, she would wake up with a fright and find Shuggy staring at her. He would be dressed, dwarfed by the bag slung over both shoulders, his face washed and his wet hair parted and brushed in the front only. She would lie there, fully dressed, trying to pull her dry lips over her teeth, while he would say, "Good morning," and then quietly turn and leave for school. He hadn't wanted to leave without letting her know he would be right back afterwards. He took her pinky in his and swore it. The house was quiet. She tilted her head forward into her hands, and the blood filled the back of her eyes. Shuggy wasn't standing there as usual. On the table in front of her was a mug of cold tea, the top already congealed with a milky skin. Next to that, a slice of white toast poked through with a clumsy knife, littered with lumps of butter too thick to spread. With a hand over her eyes, she scanned the low coffee table for something to calm the shakes. She tilted mugs towards her and looked inside for a mouthful of beer. The mugs were empty. Agnes reached for a cigarette and with a sorry whimper, pulled the last one out of the packet. She lit it with shaking fingers and took a long drag. Feeling no better, she got up and shuffled around the couch looking for hidden quarter bottles or half-finished cans. She stoted around the empty house, tipping out all the hiding places that might hold a forgotten drink, the laundry basket, behind the vinyl video case covers that were made to look like encyclopedias. On her knees, She pulled all the empty grocery bags out from underneath the kitchen sink till she knelt waist-deep in a cumulus of blue and white plastic. The panic set in. From room to room she wandered, making shrieking, sucking noises of frustration through her front teeth. She had to keep stopping to spit gobbets of rising bulk into sinks and old tea mugs. She dug out her big black leather bag and rifled round inside for her purse, sprang the metal clasp at the top and opened it. St. Jude rolled around at the bottom in a bed of fluff and grit. It was Thursday, and all the Monday and all the Tuesday benefit money was already done in. On the Monday prior, she had lain awake throughout the night waiting for the radio clock to turn to 8. In high heels and uneven eyeshadow, she had fairly run up the pit road to cash what the miners' wives called the Monday book. Standing at the back of the benefit queue, her head held high, her hands shaking in her pockets, Agnes had tried to ignore the women in their thin nylon jackets that made dry swishing noises. She stood there, separate and aloof, as they rattled with their smoker's cough, grumbling with sticky phlegm. £38 a week was meant to keep and feed them all. It made mother stand in the little shop and look at pint cartons of milk like they were a luxury. Agnes cashed the Monday book with the air of a queen. She walked directly past the milk to the front of the shop and promptly bought 12 cans of special brew. She talked cheerily about the good weather they had been having, but the Indian man said nothing. She was sure the blue elephant thing hanging behind him was giving her the hairy eyeball. She reclasped her purse demurely as he slid the cold metal tins into a plastic bag. The women behind her did sums out loud, their lips moving as they counted, adding bread to oven chips to cigarettes and then, defeated, putting the bread quietly back on the shelf. Agnes slipped back out into the street and behind the low sandstone shop. She crouched in the broken glass and popped open the first cold can. On a Tuesday morning, she went back to the shop already with a drink in her. She glided up the dual carriageway, her knees dipping elegantly with each step. Agnes cashed in her Tuesday book of £8.50 in child support. Fortified by the special brew, she told the shopkeeper that his blue elephant gave her the heebie-jeebies. But it was Thursday now. She looked down into the purse, empty but for St. Jude and the ouse gathering in the creases. Sad, selfish tears of the poor me's welled in her eyes. She raked a finger through the dirty ashtray. She needed to think what to do next. The alcohol leaving her body made it hard to watch the television, so she ran a hot bath. The water would make her feel less cold, less sore. She rinsed the sweat and flatness out of her hair. She took the flannel cloth and began wiping the taste off her teeth and lay back in the scalding water and thought how she could get some money. Across her soft middle ran a deep red welt where, after she had passed out, her black tights had dug in, bruising the flesh. She stuck her finger in the welt. It ran across her spare tire like a train track, and that made her think of the Glasgow train, Paddy's Market, which lay underneath its arches, and the pawn shop that sat there. Without drying herself, she ran about the house in a wet housecoat, looking for something to pawn. In the daylight, everything looked cheap and worthless. She turned every Capodimonte ornament in her hands and even tried picking up the black and white television. But she would never be able to hump it by foot into the city. In the bedroom, she considered her jewellery, all the odd pieces that were lying loose in an old penny bank bag, the cladder rings her mother had given her, her granny's locket, Catherine's christening bangle. It took effort, but she reluctantly put the bag back in the drawer. She did a sly amble past Leek's heavy toolbox. She nudged it with her toe. It was empty. He had taken all the tools with him to the YTS job site. He had carried it all, even the things he would surely not need. He had learned his lesson the last time she had been itching for pawn. Agnes scratched at her palm.